Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, this is Jim Stein, your host for New Books in Math, a channel of the New Books Network. Our guest today is Sethian Devadas, a co-author of Mage Merlin's Unsolved Mathematical Mysteries. There are very few math books that merit the adjective charming, but this is one of them. The authors have chosen a truly unique, creative, and charming way to acquaint readers with some of the unsolved problems of mathematics. Some are fairly well known, others less so, but all are intriguing. They have woven the problems into a coherent story, and I think you'll enjoy hearing and reading both the story and the associated problems. Sethian, welcome to the show.
Thanks for inviting me, Jim. Excited to be here.
Sethian, I understand that one of the reasons that you wrote this book was to help people realize that math is not only beautiful, but contains many apparently simple problems that even the best mathematicians have been unable to resolve. Some of the problems in the book are so easy to describe that you could really say to someone, do try this at home. Who knows, you might become famous.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the main motivating factors for us, Matt Harvey, my co-author and I, to write the book, is that when most people think about mathematics, you're either thinking about very old things, you know, like the Pythagorean theorem, a squared plus b squared equals c squared, or maybe you have a formula like the quadratic formula you might have learned in high school, hundreds if not thousands of years old, or you're thinking about some indescribable equation that you usually see in a TV show or in a movie, you know, on a chalkboard or on one of those whiteboards. And math is always at these extremes. Either it's old stuff or undecipherable stuff. And what we wanted to do is, how can you just get the reader to get an access into the edge of knowledge, kind of to get them to the frontier of math and get excited about it? So that's what really motivated us in the beginning.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I enjoyed about this book, was that the problems you chose aren't something like the Riemann hypothesis, which you would put up on one of those whiteboards, which requires a considerable background in college-level mathematics to understand. They are problems which can be readily understood with no advanced mathematics. Of course, actually solving them is likely to require some sophisticated tools, but you never know, which is part of the charm of these problems.
Yeah, I mean, one of my favorite things about just the subject of math is when you write a research paper with collaborators, everybody writes their name in alphabetical order. You know, in the sciences, a lot of times it's the person who owns the laboratory and the chemicals and has the grant. They get their name at the end, kind of saying they're the person behind, you know, behind everything. And the first author is usually the person who contributed the most, and it kind of trickles down, you know, postdocs to researchers to grad students to undergrads. But in math, the tradition has always been everybody just writes in alphabetical order. And the reason is, even one person who might have just spoken 10 words during an entire, you know, 20-week research project might have said exactly those 10 words that would have been needed to get over that hump. You know, they might have had that aha moment that somebody spending 20 weeks daily at a chalkboard might not have been able to push through. So that's one of the reasons I love mathematics, and I love a book like this where people can possibly, you know, kick the ball down the field just a little bit without realizing that I need to have put in 30 years of work to actually contribute to the edge of knowledge in this field.
And one of the things that's surprising is that happens, I won't say with some frequency, but one of the things is that incredible problems are sometimes contributed to by people that you would not expect. And that actually occurred later in your book, so I won't mention specifics now. But one person that I would like to bring up is Maryam Mirzakhani. And in some senses, the book is a tribute to her. She was a truly remarkable woman, and I think the listeners would enjoy hearing a little of her story.
Well, the theme of the book is about Camelot. So you have Merlin, who's sort of like MacGyver. You know, I grew up watching MacGyver as a kid, and he kind of gets called in to do the impossible, you know, Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. And if you kind of think about Camelot for a second, you realize there are no women in the story. I mean, there's Guinevere, but really it's, you know, Lancelot and then Percival and these Knights of the Round Table. There's Merlin, there's Arthur, and even Arthur, the classic story, he has two sons. So where are the women? So one of the things we wanted is, you know, as we chose Camelot to be the background story, because crazy things can happen and we wanted some crazy stories in here, we realized we really wanted a voice of a woman. And Maryam Mirzakhani she's a superstar. So in mathematics, you know, there's no Nobel Prize, Jim. There's only the Fields Medal. And the way the Nobel Prize works is you usually get the Nobel when you're in your 80s for work you've done in your 20s or 30s. You know, you did something in semiconductor field and 50 years of that work influencing and impacting the world makes the Nobel Committee realize, oh my gosh, this is actually worth it and how amazing that work was way back when. But the Fields Medal in mathematics, you get it every 4 years, right? So it happens sporadically. But more importantly, you have to get it before you're 40. You have to get it 39 or less. And so you must have been able to rock the mathematics world at relatively a young age and made that contribution. And in the history of the Fields Medal, no woman has ever won it, except the first and the only one has been Maryam Mirzakhani. She's an Iranian mathematician. She was a professor at Stanford. She won the medal, I think, in 2014. She's about 37 years old. And within 3 years, by the time she it was 2017, when she was 40, she passed away due to breast cancer, which was incredibly tragic. And but one of the things I loved about Miriam's work, and there's all of these biographies that are coming out, you know, through the mathematics community of people telling stories about how wonderful she was and how she worked, is that she would always be drawing and doodling. And that's sort of how she thought. Her research is related to, I mean, superficially to a certain degree related to mine. She cared about very visual things, and so do I, geometric things. But she studied sort of like lines on surfaces, like geodesics, the shortest point distance between two points on surfaces, and counting them and thinking about how they would look. And one of my favorite things is the fact that she doodled all the time, and she's this incredibly curious person. We thought, man, there's no other person like that than to be the narrator of our story.
Yeah, you know, when you were mentioning that, I was thinking of another classic doodler was Richard Feynman in physics.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I think, you know, there's so much. One of the things we wanted the book to be is this kind of pull beyond thinking about math as the feeder to technology. You know, when you think about math, it's kind of the underpinning of science, of technology, of engineering. So much of what the Silicon Valley and the buzz is about, certainly in the West Coast, and driving sort of financial models and data analytics in the East Coast in New York. And you realize, gosh, there's something very human about taking a piece of chalk or, you know, just taking a pencil and a piece of paper and just drawing these ideas out rather than staring at a computer screen. And I think more about this, especially in this COVID time that we have, right? We're all kind of wedded on this digital medium, which has been powerful, but at the same time, dehumanizing in some ways. So we wanted to kind of get away from that and to actually have a paper book where you can actually draw and doodle and play around with these things.
Yeah, you know, when I ask publishers to send me copies of books that I'm going to do podcasts on, I always want something that I can touch and feel and move my finger along the page and look at pictures. And you just can't do that with a computer screen.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm reminded of Malcolm Gladwell. One of my favorite pieces he's ever written is this piece called The Social Life of Paper. And in that, he actually says that, you know, the old way of keeping track of data were the scrolls. You know, you'd have these scrolls where you'd kind of, you know, either Hebrew scripture or Assyrian documents, Babylonian things were all in scrolls and tablets. And he said this invention of the book was remarkable because what you could do with a book, this is kind of what you're pointing at, Jim, is like you could jump to the page you want immediately, right? I guarantee if I ask you, you know, pick your favorite stories or novels or your book you grew up reading, and you can sort of tell on the bottom left corner is when Huck Finn, you know, something happened to him, or the top right in The Lord of the Rings, and you can kind of remember which parts and where in the book it was. And the iPad actually, unfortunately, kind of goes us back to the scroll world, right? Like now we have to kind of scroll through the whole thing to get down there rather than this immediate access. So we wanted this playfulness of jumping into stories and out of stories the way you wanted to.
Well, your book is certainly playful, and we'll get to that in a little bit. You know, we live in an era in which women are making substantial inroads into fields such as mathematics, in which women have been historically unrepresented. Why do you suppose this has happened in the past, and currently what are we doing to improve it? And what can be done to help more women become interested in mathematics?
Oh gosh, that's, you know, I think
it's a book in itself. It's a library in itself.
It's true. And in a very big sense, you know, we as humans are broken individuals who are selfish in many things. And regardless of how you view things in a good way, maybe the patriarchal society was good in several things, but at the same time, anything with power turns into poison and abuse. And I think, I think mathematics in many ways is a language. You know, I think of it as French or German, or where the more you speak that language, the more you get comfort in playing with it and creating with it and having a joy to it. It's just, you could think of it as baking or cooking. You know, once you know the basics, you could add to that and you have this repertoire and you can create new dishes that you never thought was possible because you're learning these little pieces of this language of how food works. But women have not historically for millennia, even the century, have not been allowed to kind of learn and speak this language of mathematics. Women I knew who mentored me were some of the, you know, first women or some of the first few women who got PhDs in several institutions, the first women allowed to get through to get PhDs in math. So you can imagine this is, you know, I'm an old man, but not that old, right? To at least understand that kind of a perspective of the fact this is recent in our time. And even if women weren't allowed to speak the language of math and to learn about it, they certainly were and are discouraged. You know, hey, that's not, you know, that might not be the right thing for you, this kind of stuff. But, you know, you should kind of fool around with these kind of things. And the moment you get that, you realize that because I kind of alluded to this thing about math being the fuel to technology, science, and engineering, there's a lot of power in the world today about who gets to be at that table and who gets to speak. And to me, more importantly, as somebody who's curious, this joy of falling in love with problems and accessing problems that are so beautiful that Miriam Mirzakhani, as an example, was able to just doodle and play with, that is, you know, that's what's heartbreaking. So, you know, to kind of answer the second part of your question about how to do this, I think to really have your eyes open towards what's happening in elementary school to junior high to high school to college, that, you know, you have people in contact with, cousins and nephews and aunts, uncles, or your own children, or even parents. But there are wonderful organizations. Like one of my favorite is the AWM, the Association for Women in Math, who have had like wonderful presidents, organizational structures, who are really embedded from almost all levels of education and academic life as to bring women to prominence and level the playing field as much as possible.
Oh, I mean, that's one of the things that we've absolutely got to do. And it's sort of interesting in that math hasn't, for the most part, math hasn't suffered from the, I guess, I don't like to invent phrases like ethnic suppression, but it doesn't seem to have happened in mathematics to the extent that there's been the gender suppression, because you can find great mathematicians in practically every country, every ethnicity, but it's awfully hard to find great mathematicians who are women. And of course, Miriam Mirzakhani and Emmy Noether, who preceded her, are two utterly outstanding examples.
I think you make a good point, but just to push back a little bit, I'd say that in America, because of racial tensions, you see clearly in disparities there, that's going to be reflected in mathematics and academia. If you, for example, if you want to see the number of African-American mathematicians in a certain region, which has a high African-American population, you see that it's very low. It's the same kind of a lens that you can look at it too. I think you're right. Nationally, or I mean, internationally, it's one story, but
Nationally, it's another. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. Even in San Diego, where I'm at, you would think that there'd be a lot of Latino, Latina mathematicians, being so close to the border, having such a rich heritage near Mexico and in the South, and I don't find that here at all. And so that is troubling.
Yeah, you know, I could go into that because the chair of the mathematics department at which I taught was Mexican, and he had an explanation for that, but that's for another interview. Let's get back to your book.
Yeah.
Anyway, as I said at the start of the interview, the problems you introduce are woven into a story. What is the theme of the story, and how did you happen to choose it? Well, we know it's Camelot, but how did you get there?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the book actually started because we wanted the book to be a reflection of what we were trying to say, the physical book itself. So it actually started originally as a children's board book, you know, like the Very Hungry Caterpillar, you know, one of those thick board books that you get and you give to a one-year-old or two-year-old or
yeah,
even a five-year-old.
Yeah, I was going to say,
Yeah, and we wanted, I mean, when I dreamt of this idea, I thought, my gosh, you know, these problems are like have a childlike quality to them. So what if we actually represented it in an embodied state that was childlike? So, you know, we wanted these chunky board books. You'd open it up and each one would be this beautiful two-page spread of a chunky board book of an unsolved problem, right? And you flip it open and you'd get to the next unsolved problem. And we thought that'd be so much fun to do. And we actually... we had a beautiful agent who pursued, you know, Penguin and Random, you know, all of these big book publishers. And it was interesting. They didn't know what to do with it because it was either they would fall it into the kids section, you know, where it would be to the Very Hungry Caterpillar, right?
Yeah.
Which wouldn't make sense because you still need some maturity to understand these problems.
Sure.
Or they would see, well, how is this book going to be sitting next to Richard Feynman's book or Richard Dawkins book on the shelf, right? When they have those big books and all of a sudden you have this little board book. And so they just didn't even know how to pitch it. And the more we talked about this book to MIT and to several other editors, one of the things that came up with our friends was that they were frustrated that if we did have a board book, that there was no, one of my friends, Matt Nix, who's a TV writer and producer, he said there's sort of no answer key. I mean, not that there was an answer key that you needed,
but
he just wanted to like
problems.
Lift the hood of the car a little bit, right? And like, gosh, you know, how would I even begin to approach these problems? And my co-author and I, Matt and I, didn't want the readers to go to Wikipedia, right? We didn't want to have them leave the book to click on something to understand more about the problem. We want it to be right there. So that's when, you know, when we were fooling around with this stuff, we thought, oh, what if there's a narrator who's able to explain the problem a little bit more? And so that story started getting woven in. So the book went from a little chunky board book to almost like a picture book, like a 6x8 beautiful picture book. So the story of Camelot, the reason we picked some kind of a king and a queen basically was simply because we needed our characters to do crazy things. You know, if you're going to have these unsolved problems, we wanted all of the problems to be connected to each other. I don't think there's even a mention of an equation in any of the Merlin pages, right? Merlin's just talking about building tents in the middle of a forest or trying to fix a broken window or arranging rowboats. You know, it's just really simple, straightforward day-to-day stuff you'd see. So we wanted a kind of a down-to-earth thing, but at the same time, he was arranging 100 rowboats, right? Or making 100 tents in the field or making a monument with 33 oak trees that grew to the sky. So we wanted something crazy, somebody who had basically infinite money. And so we settled on a king and a queen, and we thought Merlin would be a cool punchline to kind of go around that story.
Yeah, you know, in the start of the book, you use an ice cream cone to describe your view of unsolved math problems. And I thought that was an intriguing way to do so.
One of the things that I think that you kind of pointed at one of the philosophical points we wanted to make, which is, you know, most people think of mathematics as, or maybe even academics in general, but certainly in the mathematical perspective, as this mountain, almost like you know, the Himalayas you're trying to climb, right? You want to climb Everest or Fuji. And the way you think of it is like, well, you know, the base is sort of the elementary school. You're learning addition and subtraction. And as you kind of climb the mountain, you know more and more math. And, you know, many people kind of drop out at a certain level, right? Math altitude sickness sets in. And gosh, you know, I'm done at a trig. You know, one of the things I want to point out to them is when I asked people, you know, I give talks all over and I ask them, hey, you know, I'm a mathematician and we have this conversation. The first thing most people say is that how, I guess, they want me to forgive them of their mathematical sins because they remember clearly where they stopped climbing the ladder, right? If I ask most people what the last history class they took was, they say, I don't know what the last history class, because was it Japanese-American, was it World War II? I don't remember. I took it in high school. I took it in college. I don't remember what that last, and they say, what's the last English class, right? Oh, was it Shakespeare or was that after I took the one on Beowulf, right? But if I ask them what the last math class is, they could tell you the day they took that last final exam and they never had to look at pre-calc again, right? It's so seared into their memories. And so people remember if you have this like mountain analogy, they think exactly when they stopped going up that mountain. I said, you know, I got off at like, you know, at 1500 altitude or 3200 altitude. And they just remember those things. And they think the very tip of the mountain is kind of the snow and the goodness of unsolved mathematics, right? Only the gods make it to the top where the real good stuff is. And what we wanted to do literally was to flip that on its head. And my belief is that mathematics is like an ice cream cone filled with ice cream. You know, the entire cone is filled with ice cream and there's this big scoop on top. And even if you take a bite at the very bottom, you're still getting a little bit of ice cream. And, you know, as you kind of nibble your cone from the bottom up, you're getting more and more ice cream. And I think of those ice cream as unsolved problems.
Yeah, you know, I'm sorry. Didn't mean to.
No, I think of those things as unsolved problems where even if you take the idea of just addition and multiplication, you now know problems in mathematics that nobody knows how to solve. And of course, the more of the cone you know, the more unsolved problems are available to you. And by the top, you know, by the time you get to a doctorate level, man, there are mounds of these things, and you realize it's infinitely many unsolved problems out there that you can play with till the day you die for generations. But even with the basic stuff, you still have access to it, and you don't need to make it to the top of the mountain. It's right there for you waiting.
You sure don't. One of the things, as you were just talking, it occurred to me that your experiences in telling people that you're a mathematician are slightly different from mine because, well, first of all, I'm older than you, but I always got one of two reactions. They would always say either, that was always my worst subject, or I'll bet you can really balance your checkbook.
Yes. Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up, Jim, because one of the other notions we wanted to, maybe one of these fallacies we wanted to break through was the notion that math is exactly about numbers and equations, right? And so people think that, gosh, you know, I know about addition and subtraction, maybe prime numbers, and there's some formulas with the, you know, things getting squared. And so what do you do as a research mathematician? You must be squaring and cubing things forever, right? And we just wanted to get this notion of the playfulness of mathematics that, yeah, the numbers are part of it, but numbers are one way of measuring things. Some people are great at studying and quantifying numbers. I'm not. Some people are great at studying and quantifying functions and change, you know, sine and cosine and exponential functions. And that's not my gift. But some people love to study patterns about shape. And that's what I love to do. I love geometry and topology, which is about shape. So one of the things we were really intentional about the book is we wanted to slice through as many different kinds of mathematics as possible as these subjects within math to get a flavor for our audience to get and to fall in love with.
You know, I couldn't have asked for a better setup line to get into some of the math problems that you investigate, because I want to discuss those because they're so much fun. And the first one in the book is one you call the Great Hall Window, which I'd never seen before. And it's absolutely lovely. Why don't you tell the listeners about it?
Yeah, it's one of my favorite problems. I think we wanted to open the book with that problem because it's ridiculous. I mean, this problem is almost the definition of what the book is about in terms of the example that it shows. So here's the real straight up thing. And of course, it has that Camelot a veneer on top of this thing about Merlin trying to cover a window in this beautiful sacred hall that's protecting Excalibur, the sword. But, you know, if you kind of strip that down a little bit and kind of just for our listeners to understand, the problem goes like this. Imagine you have a 2x2 square, a simple square that's two, you know, length two on one side and height two on the other and 2x2. You could easily take 4 1x1 little squares and cover it up, right? Imagine the 2x2 square shining light, and you want to cover up the light. So you put 4 of these 1x1. Absolutely straightforward to do, that you could see that visually in your mind's eye. And now the problem changes a little bit, just a little bit. In fact, it changes almost microscopically. Imagine you have a 2.0000001 by 2.0001 squared. In other words, the square has just gotten bigger, just a hair's length on every side, and light is still shining through it. And now the question is, you have these one-by-one tiles. You have a bunch of them on the floor, and you can use those tiles to cover up to make sure not a crack of light comes through this 2x2 square. It's a little bit bigger than a 2x2. And Heidi, how many tiles do you need? Now, the rule is you can't crush the tiles, right? You can't break them and fill in the grout. But you can place them on top of each other. You could rotate them. You can move them in any way you want to cover up this window opening. And if you think about it a little bit, you see that 9 tiles, 3 by 3 by 3 is way overkill, but it does it. And as most beautiful math results go, like questions go, can you make it, you know, can you name that tune in 8 tiles? And can you name that tune in 7 tiles? Can you do it with less and less work? How much can you get away with? 4 is way too little, because 4 will give you that 2x2, but you're still going to miss that crack. So
you don't have enough area with 4.
You don't even have enough area, exactly, right? So 5, it turns out you have tons of area, because if you have, you know, 5 1x1 tiles, that's more than enough area for that little 2x2 with a little extra kick. But you can mathematically prove that 5 will never work. And the proof is beautiful. It's geometric. It's elegant. And you can actually show, and we show in this book, that 7 does work. You can actually get away with 7. You can rotate the other tiles a little bit in a very clever, symmetric way, and you can cover it with 7. And the magic number is 6. So 5's too little. 7 works. Can you get away with 6? And that's unsolved. And I found that ridiculous, is the sense that no mathematician has ever figured out how this problem works, uncovering a square with little squares. And not only is that problem unsolved, but one of the things that we show as Miriam, our narrator, is, you know, once you see Merlin struggle with covering it up with those 6 tiles, she then in the next few pages goes behind the scenes a little bit. This is the non-answer key, where she's able to tell you, well, here's the bigger problem that problem falls under. And here's the bigger language of mathematics that people care about. And, you know, we've tried these kind of things, and here's the limits to our knowledge so far. So I love that insight that she could offer too, even if, not that it's going to help you get unstuck a little bit, but just to give you a framing of this bigger story.
You know, thinking about this problem and the fact that you originally wanted to do this as sort of a board book, yeah. You could actually do this problem and fit the square, you know, fit the squares in and say, here, can you do this? Give them 6 1x1s and the 2.01 by 2.01. And you could have done that with a board book, but at least you can describe it here, and that's all that's necessary, because somebody can just get, you know, sheets of paper and do it.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that actually goes nicely with this book itself, we've been fooling around with this thing, should there be like a kit, you know, just like a plastic kit of some of these things that people can play with. And, you know, that's one of those struggles we've been having in our heads. But there's also a joy in just getting a piece of chalk and going to, you know, a sidewalk or, you know, just a stencil with some, you know, some pen and paper, and just actually you cutting things up and fooling around with it. And, you know, there's another problem in here about unfolding boxes, right? These Amazon boxes you might be getting nowadays due to COVID. And it's this beautiful gift wrapping thing where you could just actually go and just play with boxes by yourself.
We'll get to that in a little bit, because that's one of the problems I wanted to discuss. But the next one I sort of alluded to a little earlier in the interview, you call it the Blessed Birthday Banquet, but it's actually about a very, very famous problem in which recently some surprising inroads were made. It's called the twin prime conjecture.
Yeah, this is... I think you bring a beautiful contrast. The first problem actually was not well known at all in the mathematics circle. It's a problem that kind of appears in discrete geometry and kind of pokes its head in computational geometry. But the second problem, this Blessed Birthday Banquet, is probably one of the most famous problems in all of mathematics, the twin primes conjecture. And it's a beautiful, beautiful, elegant problem, and it's... It feels like it's absolutely doable. So here's the question. If you think about a prime number is something that's not made up of numbers kind of multiplied and put together. So 7 is a prime number, but 9 is made up of 3 and 3 put together. So 9 is not prime. So here's a really simple question. You think about these prime numbers, and imagine prime numbers are kind of glowing red in the number line, right? So all of the regular numbers, the whole numbers are glowing white, but then the prime numbers, the special ones, kind of glow red. And if you look at this number line and you look at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and it keeps going down, you realize that the prime numbers, the red dots glow less and less. There's less and less of them because there's a lot of these white ones that you could multiply together to get more and more of these other ones. So you're running out of these red dots. But if you keep going far enough, you keep seeing these red dots. And the question that was asked by Euclid, actually, 300 BCE, is do these prime numbers go on forever? And he was able to prove, you know, over 2,000 years ago, yes, the prime numbers do go on forever, right? So that's a classic result. It takes like a few lines. It's a beautiful result to get people excited about it. And the proof is elegant. And then the question was, well, if you stare at these things, these primes come in a funny grouping. For example, you notice that 3 and 5 are prime and they're right next to each other. Now, when I say right next to, the number between it is an even number, 4. And 4, you know, any even number will never be prime because it's you can divide by 2. So let's kind of get rid of the even guys for now and just look at the odd ones. And notice that 3 and 5 are next to each other. 5 and 7 are literally next to each other. So we call them twins. And then, you know, 7 and 9, well, 9 is not prime, but 11 and 13 are, and then 17 and 19 are. So there are these kind of primes, these red lights that come in pairs. It's not just these glowing red lights that go on forever because of Euclid in the sea of white, but these reds somehow kind of pop up in pairs also. And the question was, do these twin prime numbers exist forever as you look down there? In other words, for any number you could imagine, 285 trillion, is there a twin prime that comes after that? And gosh, Jim, this is crazy, but you know, so little progress in one sense has been made that we were almost spinning our wheels. Now, this question opened the door to lots of other questions and beautiful mathematics machinery, from number theory to algebraic geometry to even topology. A lot of things kind of were in that area. But I think you alluded to this remarkable thing that happened less than a decade ago, about 7 years ago. In 2013, there's a mathematician, Yitang Zhang, where he came up with this result. He said, okay, I can't tell you if the twin primes are there forever, but I can tell you that if you find a prime, I'm going to find another prime that's less than 70 million away from that one. And that goes on forever. In other words, primes forever will come in these pairs where they're 70 million apart from each other. Now, of course, what we want that is you want that number to be not 70 million, right? But you want that number to be 2. You want it to be like 3 plus 2 is 5 and 11 plus 2 is 13. You want it to be just 2 away. You'd love to shrink that 70 million down to 2. But man, we had nothing until 2013. And this amazing result comes out due to dedication, hard work, and standing on the shoulders of brilliant mathematicians. And so Zhang kind of rocked the world with this. And then the moment that breakthrough happened, the moment Zhang introduced a set of tools and ideas and thought that people hadn't thought about before, then people took that. And now the number, I think, is 246. So instead of 70 million, we've shrunk that down to always primes come in these pairs that are at most 246 apart. We'd like to shrink that 246 down to 2. And that's the state of the art right now.
Now, you know, one of the things also that I find fascinating about the Zhang story is Zhang worked at a school that probably nobody else who's famous in mathematics had ever come from, the University of New Hampshire. He was a part-timer and he was supporting himself. He was supporting himself by managing a subway franchise while he was working on this problem.
Yeah, that, I mean, one of the most beautiful stories in mathematics in recent times about dedication, perseverance, but most importantly, just the love of mathematics, right? Zhang is just kind of working when he can get it, has his foot in the door, but he's spending his time just chipping away and chipping away. And when actually asked why people hadn't done what Zhang had done, you know, when you'd ask the other mathematicians who were experts in the field, they just said, well, you could, but man, you just have to have this persistence to chip away at that. You know, if you want to go and appear on the other side of the mountain that way, man, you got to go through it and be just faithfully diligent. We were trying to find shortcuts in elegant ways. And so there's this notion of kind of his character coming through it, this beauty of what it means to be a human and at the same time a mathematician. Oh my gosh, it's amazing.
Yeah, it's a great story. We've got just a number of problems here because I think you have like 15 or 16 in the book. No way we can talk about all of them. But because you alluded to this one a little earlier, I'd like to talk about it. It's one you call glorious gift wrappings.
Yes. Oh my gosh. This is actually a problem that's close to my heart. I'm actually, this problem is, what's the right way of framing it? It's so elegant and gorgeous and becoming more popular that I am trying to solve not this problem, but problems kind of around this that have this kind of a flavor. So it's something that's close to my own personal research. But the problem is simply stated as this. Imagine you have a box. And the box is not a rectangular box, but just a random shaped box, you know, random triangles and pentagons and, you know, some weird. Imagine you've taken Mickey Mouse and put Mickey Mouse in a box, right? Like the ears are sticking out and who knows how these polygons are put in around Mickey Mouse. The only rules are, of course, that the sides of the box have to be flat, right? So it's made up of a bunch of flat panels that have been sewn together, stitched together along these hinges, these edges of the box. And now the question is the following thing. If you have such a box that's all closed up, can you take a knife and cut the box up so that the box unfolds? You're almost like peeling the box like an orange so that it unfolds. And you have a couple of conditions. It has to unfold. It has to lay flat on the floor. And then the pieces have to not overlap. So it has to be a connected, unfolded thing that lies flat on the floor so the pieces can't overlap. And it turns out that when you actually try this you can create a computer program that randomly creates such boxes. And then you could try to cut it up in lots of different ways. And it turns out there always happens to be ways to do it for every box we've tried. But of course, there are infinitely many boxes and we're only trying finitely many of them. So the question is that there's a little tweak to this question, Jim, that I find actually more fascinating. And this is actually motivated by the work of Albrecht Dürer. Renaissance superstar. And, you know, one of the things that Dürer wanted to do was he wanted to draw polyhedra, you know, the dodecahedron or the cube or, you know, any kind of a polyhedral structure. He wanted to draw it, but he wanted to preserve the geometry. He wanted to talk about the cube that looked like 90 degrees everywhere, you know, nice sharp corners at the end, these 90 degree corners. But if you look at any drawing, you know, you need to have that perspective drawing, right? Like you need to have that pointed infinity. So when you're putting a cube and you're trying to draw this thing, you know, the angles always kind of bend a little bit because you have to draw it in space. So it looks like this perspective drawing. So he was thinking like, how do I draw a cube, but yet have the 90 degreeness to a cube and talk about the panels. And I want it to be all connected so people can get the cubiness for it. And he came up with this really cool idea, which in a cool way, nobody had thought of seriously before, where he actually cut along the edges of the cube. So he did the same thing that I'm talking about, which is cut along the box so it unfolds flat, it stays connected, and the flaps don't overlap, right? He wanted to do that, except he restricted himself to only cutting along the edges because the edges are where the seams and the weaknesses are anyway. So let's just, you know, like visually imagine, take a regular cube and you can actually imagine cutting along the edges and flapping it open. So it actually looks like a cross, right? These six squares that form a cross, the four sides around each around a square kind of flap up. And then the longer side of the cross flaps up and, you know, caps the top. So that's one way you can unfold the cube. And there are lots of different ways of unfolding it. And what Dürer did was he actually took Platonic solids and Archimedean solids, these beautiful symmetric objects, you know, that he had learned from Euclid and all these superstars that had existed hundreds and hundreds of years ago. And he started unfolding them and came up with these beautiful drawings of unfoldings. And those things are called nets. It's a net of a polyhedron. And then the question was, given any convex polyhedron, things that look like a cube or a sphere where one side and the other side are visible being on the inside of it, that's not the horn of a Viking, but a convex object. Given one of these polyhedra, can you always cut along the edges and lay it flat? And this problem was really brought to light in the 80s. And when the computer scientists kind of came in and intersected the mathematicians about thinking about these ideas of geometry, and it is absolutely unsolved. In fact, one of my favorite things about this problem, Jim, is that if you're asking the experts in the world today, if you have to bet on this thing being true or false, in other words, yes, every polyhedron ever made that's convex, you can cut along the edges and lay it flat and get a net, I'd say it's a 50-50 shot. Most people would think, yeah, sure. You'd think everything we've ever tried, every computer software that's ever run has always been able to find one that works. So yeah, of course, we think everything is going to work. We just don't know why it's going to work. On the other hand, there's a group of mathematicians and computer scientists who are, I'd say, a good, you know, an equally good majority on this side too, 51%, 51% almost on that side, who'd say, you know what, maybe the reason it's working is all of these things are have so much, so little symmetry. Maybe there's a crazy object that's so symmetric that no matter how you try to cut it, it's always going to mess you up. And we just don't understand this notion of cutting just yet. So it's really cool about even putting the bet on the solution for this thing, right? Unlike the previous problem that we talked about this twin primes thing, where people think it is true and you're getting closer and closer to that mystical number of p+2, now we don't even know what the instinct is going to be. So it's I love it.
You know, one of the things that I really enjoyed about reading your book is coming across unsolved problems that I'd absolutely never heard of before. Mm-hmm. And the next one that I want to discuss was the perfect cake combinations problem, because it's hard to imagine one that's easier to understand and beautiful.
Yeah, this is a very different problem than the previous ones we've been talking about. And part of it is the intentionality of kind of mixing these up. But this problem really has to do with numbers, right? So far, we've been thinking about, you know, wrapping geometric objects or, you know, the windows and the squares. The twin prime conjecture got to this notion of numbers by multiplying. And this cake problem comes to numbers by factoring. So if you could imagine a number like 6 and look at all of its factors, the things that make up 6, you would see that, you know, 1 divides into 6, 2 does, and then 3 does. 4 doesn't, 5 doesn't, of course 6 itself does, but we look at the proper ones, right? Not the ones that it's itself. And if you look at those numbers 1, 2, and 3, and you add it up, 1 plus 2 plus 3, you get 6. That's cool. And then you try this, you know, you try it for some other number like 21, right? So 1 goes into 21, 3 goes into 21, 7 goes into 21, and that's it. And so 1 plus 3 plus 7 is 11, which is not 21. So 6 is a very special number because its factors kind of add up to give you this number 6. And then after that, you realize, for example, like 28, 1 plus 2 plus 4 plus 7 plus 14, those are the factors of 28, will actually add up to give you 28. And so, Jim, those numbers are called perfect numbers. And it turns out if you kind of look at the art of perfect numbers and actually study them, you know, 6 is one of them and 28 is one of them, it's actually quite difficult to find these guys. Just how do you actually come up with another perfect number? You got to sort of try every factoring and add it up. And is there some trick? Is there some pattern? Is there something that's going to point to something? In fact, it is absolutely unsolved whether there are infinitely many perfect numbers. You know, unlike primes, we know there are infinitely many of them because Euclid told us that 2,300 years ago. But for perfect numbers, we don't even know if there are infinitely many of them or if we've sort of found them all. So that is crazy. That is amazing. And the second part of that, what we kind of focus on in this part is it turns out every one of these perfect numbers happened that we've found so far all happen to be even. So can you find an odd perfect number? Can you find a perfect number that has to be an odd number? There's nothing instinctively about a perfect number that says it has to be even. There's none of its DNA or anything like that points to its evenness, but it turns out that's the case and we don't know why. So we've phrased this whole problem into cutting cakes where the sizes of the cakes are based on the factoring and you're putting these pieces of these cakes together to get this bigger piece that you want to serve to King Arthur and Queen Guinevere and things like that. So yeah, I love that problem.
You know, I could make this interview go for several hours discussing all the problems, but unfortunately we only have 50 to 55 minutes, and there are a few more that just appeal to me so much and I wanted to get to them. One of them was a problem that you called Holy Grail Vault. Not only do I love the problem and it's easy to understand, but an individual named Ernst Strauss made a contribution to it. Ernst Strauss was Einstein's assistant back in the 30s, I think at Columbia, and he taught at UCLA while I was teaching at UCLA. So I actually knew someone.
Oh, that's cool. That is cool.
So let's discuss that problem.
Yeah, the story from the Camelot's world goes on that the Holy Grail has been found and Arthur and the knights are trying to find a way to keep it safe. And so they devise, they ask this question, is there a way to create a special vault to keep it in? And the Grail kind of emits this light. And the punchline of the vault is the following thing. And it's really simple for us to kind of imagine in our mind's eye. If I create a polygon, just a polygon on a piece of paper, just, you know, straight side edges and close it up. You could make it any size you want to, any shape you want to. But imagine that the walls of the polygon are made of mirrors. So you're in a mirrored room. So you're standing there in the polygon. And when light travels, you know, it bounces off of mirrors, right? You're in that dressing room at that store before COVID hit when we were at dressing rooms and stores. And you can kind of like see
that time.
Yeah, see like the light, you know, your infinite copies of yourself and things like that, because there's a mirror behind you and all these things. And so the idea is, if somebody gives you a polygon and they make make all of it mirrored on the walls, can you position a candle somewhere, or can you put the grail somewhere so that the entire polygon is lit? In other words, light travels so much that any point you're at, there is a sequence of bounces that goes back to the source of light, that there's no darkness. And that's the problem, that given any polygon, made of mirrored walls, you must be able to find a light source in a spot that's going to light it up. Either find a polygon that doesn't work like that, or show me that every polygon works like that. And I love it. So far, the ball has been moved in different ways, and a lot of cool ideas have come about in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. But the problem still remains open for sort of a general polygon. It's beautiful.
Well, you know, talking about the ball having been moved, another way to visualize this, as you point out, is that instead of having a room with mirrored walls, you have a billiard table.
Yes, exactly. And now you can start imagining different parts of mathematics playing a role. You could imagine people in computer science or geometry caring about the light and reflection. People in physics caring about those lights and reflections. At the same time, the billiard ball, this reaction of exactly how the ball is going to traverse, if the ball has, in some sense, infinite, you know, energy to keep going, can your cue ball get to every point on the billiard table? That's exactly right, Jim. That's a great way of looking at it. In fact, that's how it has been progressed so far based on that perspective. Totally right.
As I said, you know, the problems here in this book I found fascinating. And one that I liked and relates to something we were discussing earlier, because it relates to the Pythagorean theorem, is the one that you call knight square formation.
Yeah, that's an interesting problem. It's... So if you think about the Pythagorean theorem, the way we phrased it is we wanted to look at it as knights marching out, and the way the knights would march out are in formations of squares. So imagine you have a formation of a 3x3 that forms 9 soldiers, and you have another formation of 4x4 that forms 16 soldiers. So, you know, both of those groupings, those formations are in perfect squares, but they can get together and form kind of a superstructure. These 9 and these 16 can get together. 9 plus 16 is 25. Then you're going to get a bigger 5x5 square of formation. And so here's King Arthur trying to defend the realm. The knights are getting together. Merlin's called out to do stuff. And they're trying to figure out, okay, so if you have these formations of two groups of soldiers where they can get together and form this bigger one, is it possible to get a formation of three groups of soldiers where you have a group, the first group that forms a square, and another group that forms a square, and the third, the A group, the B group, and the C group, so that every combination of them also forms perfect squares. So A and B can get together to form this bigger square, just like 9 and 16 got together to form 25. And then B and C can do it. And then A and C can do it. In fact, all three can do it. And this ABC, this big, massive army that you can create, is that possible? And it alludes, or actually it's in some sense pushing the Pythagorean theorem, because A squared plus B squared equals C squared, that's Pythagorean theorem, is exactly what we see in terms of this notion of 3 squared plus 4 squared equals 5 squared for the 9, 16, and 25. And beautiful work has been done. You could bring in number theory. You could bring in geometry. Lots of cool ideas have been pushed forward. But one of my favorite ways of viewing the problem is actually called the perfect brick.
I love that way. Yeah, that was the one that appealed to me.
Yeah, and it's imagine a brick with sides. You know, if the three formations are like A, B, and C, imagine the sides are A and B and C of the three length, width, and height of a brick. You want the brick to have whole numbers, A, B, and C to be a whole number. That's fine. We all can come up with bricks with whole number sides. But you also want the diagonals of the brick. So if this is an A, B-sided brick, the diagonal that goes from one corner to the other one, well, the length of that diagonal is C, right? A squared plus B. That's a little Pythagorean theorem showing up there. So that you want that diagonal also to be a nice whole number. So not only do you want the brick sides to be whole numbers, but their diagonals to be whole numbers, but you also want the long diagonal that goes from one corner of the brick through the brick all the way to the other side. You want that to be a whole number too. And so far, we can make everything work, but not the long diagonal. So that long one always kind of eludes us. We can get all the little sides going and the pieces of A's, B's, and C's and combinations, but you put them all together, the ABC, and we got nothing. So that's the state of the art right now.
Just out of curiosity, can you make one with in which the long diagonal is an integer and two of the other three are integers also, but you can't?
Yes. Exactly right. It's the constraint that's catching us. Exactly right.
Yeah, it's not the long diagonal. It's the fact that you can do three but not four.
Exactly right. It's an over-constrained system of what it feels like, but we don't know if that's true or not.
And the last problem that I want to discuss, which is the last problem in the book, is one of the is one of the great unsolved problems in mathematics that people really have never heard of. You call it Lady of the Lake. It's the collapse conjecture.
Yeah, this is the perfect dinner table conversation problem. You know, you sit there or at the airport or somebody you're meeting, and I love this problem because you could it's based on just the most simplest of ideas, which is multiplying and adding. So somebody gives you a whole number. Let's take the number as 20. Then the question is, if somebody gives you a number, if it's an even number, you cut that number in half, right? Because it's even, you have the right to cut it, and you get another whole number. So 20 becomes 10. Now you have 10 as your new number. If they give you that number, if it's an even number, you cut it in half, which now becomes 5. Great. But the moment you get 5, you know, once you've kind of pulled all the evenness out of the number, because you keep dividing it by it, then it becomes an odd number. If somebody gives you an odd number, then you multiply it by 3 and add 1. Now, that's a weird thing, Jim, but let's play that game. Like, you multiply by 3 and add 1. So 5 now all of a sudden becomes 3 times 5 is 15 plus 1. It's become 16, right? And you know multiplying by 3 keeps the oddness, right? An odd times an odd is an odd. But the adding 1 makes it into an even 1, which now allows you to divide by 2. So now 16 divides by 2 goes to 8. 8 divides by 2 goes to 4. 4 divides by 2 goes to 2, which then eventually goes to 1. And here's the question. Can you ever start at a number, a nice whole number, that you play this game, even, cuts it in half, odd, multiplies by 3 and adds 1 to make it even? If you play that game, can you ever start at a number that doesn't end in 1? Does every number you start with eventually trickle down and ends into the funnel of 1? And the number I picked, 20, you know, landed at 1. And you could try this with the number 3, right? So 3 times 3 is 9 plus 1 is 10, which then becomes 5, which then becomes 16 to 8 to 4 to 2 to 1. And, you know, you could try this for everything. And this simple little thing about 3 times n plus 1, sometimes it's called a 3n plus 1 conjecture or 3x plus 1 conjecture. Either you need to show that there are numbers that kind of have a holding pattern, right, that kind of cycle through, like it goes, it kind of gets near one, but it misses it, and then has a big loop that it keeps going on the loop over and over again. Or it kind of has a pattern that shoots off to infinity, right? It's actually going in, not even in the funnel, just takes off out of the funnel. Either it has a holding pattern or it just flies away. And this has a very chaos theory-like
Yeah, it does,
feel,
doesn't
right?
it?
Because of this iteration, you kind of hit it over and over again. Either you get into some cycle of stability, or some very unstable thing that flies out of the handle, but nothing is kind of converging to one. And so far, everything we're trying is kind of converging to one. But more importantly, we have no idea why. And just, I think what you had alluded to about the Collapse conjecture, Paul Erdős, very famous mathematician whose fingers are all over the different fields of math. One of the things he said is that mathematics is not yet ready for such problems. You know, and just going back to what you had talked about earlier on kind of the framework of this book, you know, if I think about almost any discipline, like if I think about music, you could think about the state of the art, like, you know, Beyonce's albums, like, wow, that is, there's somebody dealing with very hard issues and presenting it musically that I never thought that creativity was there. And if you think about art, like one of my favorite artists is Julie Mertu or Jean-Michel Béchiat, like it's amazing works in terms of how they're struggling with different things, or physics and quantum computing and literature of J.K. Rowling and Harry Potter and a thousand things. But in math, you realize this little problem about multiplying by 3 and adding 1 or dividing by 2. Paul Erdős is saying that this problem is given to us when we're not even ready to handle that thing yet. And this goes back to how little we know in this beautiful, gorgeous world of mathematics. And we're just scratching its surface.
Yeah, Seth, and it's been a pleasure doing this interview. I'd like to ask how listeners can get in touch with you, because I'm sure some will.
I think the best way to do this is just email works the best. So I'm an academic. So my last name, davidoss@sandiego.edu. Feel free to send me an email. It's the start of the semester and, you know, we're kind of pushing through, but I might be a little slow in getting back to you as we, you know, get the gears oiled. But yeah, I'd love to hear from listeners.
That's my penultimate question. My ultimate question is, and I have a feeling that if I were to get a full answer from you on this, we'd run on for hours. But do you have any future projects we might find interesting and get to talk about again?
I think instead of a particular project, I guess I could tell you about a philosophy. And my philosophy is asking this question, what does it mean to embody mathematics? If we've been thinking about mathematics with our minds, and we've done amazing things with thinking about our mathematics with our minds, what does it mean if we can actually touch math, if we can smell math, if we can use our senses as humans to push mathematics forward, not just our minds, but our minds and our bodies? What would that look like? So that's been my goal for the past, you know, 5 to 10 years, and I'm going to spend probably my lifetime pushing that.
You know, I've spent over 60 years in mathematics, and I have never heard anybody enunciate that particular idea. So it's always nice to hear something new and different, and it's been a pleasure, and I wish you the best, and I hope I hear from you again.
Thanks, Jim. It's so lovely. Thanks for your kindness in all of this.
Sure. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks.